Welcome to season four of the Raise Your Game Show, a podcast that unpacks and dissects the strategies and principles of high performance in sports and business. I'm your host, Alan Stein Jr.
Let's do it.
In this season, I unpack the key stories and lessons from my book, Raise Your Game. High performance secrets from the best of the best. If you've already read or listened to my book, please enjoy the reinforcement and reminders. Remember, repetition is not punishment. If this is all new to you, I hope you find this content helpful. You can order the full audiobook at audible.com or wherever audiobooks are sold. You can also order the paperback or hard copy version for you or your entire team or organization at raiseyourgamebook.com. Now, before I get started, I wanted to share one more thing. Do you have a son or daughter that is a middle school, high school, or college-age student-athlete? If so, I just created an online course called Your Game Plan, Student-Athlete Edition. It is an on-demand digital course that reinforces the traits, habits, and mindset necessary for student-athletes to achieve high performance academically and athletically. This course is a comprehensive collection of concepts I've shared with numerous college and professional coaches and D1 athletes that teach proven strategies on how to achieve maximum performance, create championship caliber habits, develop a winner's mindset, be the teammate you want to play with, and to lead authentically with impact. This course was designed for the student athletes that are truly committed to their growth and development and want to be the best they're capable of. If that is your son or daughter, this is the best investment you can make. Your Game Plan Student Athlete Edition will launch at the beginning of next week. It will open with a limited time offer to save 30% and receive a ton of free exclusive bonuses. The sooner you order, the more you'll get and the more you'll save. Make sure you follow me on Instagram and Twitter at Alan Stein Jr. Subscribe to my email list at alansteinjr.com or keep listening to the rest of this season for specific launch details. In today's episode, we explore Chapter 12 from the team section, which focuses on unselfishness. There is no limit to what a man can do as long as he does not care a straw who gets the credit for it. Charles Edward Montague, author. Society tends to propagate the idea that life is zero sum, that in order for me to win, you have to lose. This happens with athletes battling for playing time and with employees fighting for the same promotion or carrying envy about someone else's success. We see it on a macro level in business and in the nature of capitalism itself. We see it in the tendency to seek status and material wealth in an effort to keep up with the Joneses. In my opinion, we are all born inherently selfish. As a father, I didn't have to teach my children to look out for themselves first. That came naturally to them. Before they could even speak, when crying was their primary form of communication, all they cared about was their own interest, to be fed, to take a nap, to have their diaper changed. Like most children, some of their first words were, "No," and "Mine." Selfishness was wired in their DNA. Their mother and I had to teach them to be unselfish, to share, and to give. Adults need to be reminded of this as well. My longtime friend, Matt King, who is a brilliant basketball coach and consultant with USA Youth Basketball, once told me, "You don't have to remind me each morning to look out for myself and to do me. I do that naturally. We all do." What we all need to be reminded of us is that we are part of something bigger, and it's not about us. When it comes to achievement, working together is more efficient and productive than everyone doing his own thing. Any of the players that sit on the end of the bench at a high school like DeMatha or a college like Duke could absolutely have a larger role somewhere else. They would get a lot more playing time and attention at other schools, but they choose to give up personal accolades for collective success. These players opt for the smaller role to be a part of something much bigger than themselves. We often call these types team players, and they are the glue that keeps groups together. The art of the backup. Swin Nader is a rarity. He is the only college basketball player in history selected in the first round of the NBA draft who never started a college game. He is also the only player to have led both the NBA and the ABA in rebounding. An accident? A fluke? Neither. It was all about whom Nader spent his college career playing under and with. As the reserve center at UCLA in the 1970s, Swin Nader played backup to Hall of Fame legend Bill Walton for two championship teams under John Wooden. I was a bit in awe when I spoke to him, as I would argue that Nader is the epitome of unselfishness. Not only did he never start a single game for those UCLA teams, but there was never a moment when that seemed possible. He had the option of leaving UCLA. Other teams wanted him, but he didn't take it. In fact, he told me, "I never thought twice about leaving." Nader came to basketball late in life. He didn't play high school ball and only had a couple of junior college years on the court before transferring to UCLA. Maybe it was because he came to basketball later than most players that he approached it with a unique unselfishness. That attitude likely made his career. He wanted to become a professional and figured practicing against Bill Walton and UCLA every day was a good step in that direction, as he told me. Would he have made it to the NBA as a dominant center on another team? Maybe. Or maybe not. Perhaps he wouldn't have developed his game and gotten any better because he wouldn't have had a reason to. This chapter was originally called Selflessness, but when I interviewed Swin, he said the word sounded too much like taking yourself away, which wasn't the goal at all. Unselfishness is not losing yourself, he told me. It's almost the opposite. It's taking your talents, the ones that are needed, and using those to benefit the team, the ones that the coach decides that you should use. So I changed the name of this chapter. Swin understood the place where unselfishness and success intersect. He didn't sacrifice a career because of unselfishness. He built one off it. As Coach Wooden told him, the best thing you can do for the team is to improve yourself. When I asked him what made him choose to spend his college career as a backup, when he could have transferred anywhere to be a starter, likely raising his profile and his draft prospects, he answered thoughtfully. That's not an instant decision. That's something you decide upon because the culture at UCLA was such. That was the culture of Coach Wooden. He never took credit for any victories or good play. He always gave credit to the players, and publicly. And mostly, not the scorers, the other guys who did the little things. Rebounds, great passes, stopped a great opponent defensively. By example, the culture was set and he enforced it, in practice and in games. Swin emphasized that under Wooden, he didn't develop an interest in self-glory. It's all about the group, he told me, and what's needed for them to run productively and effectively. Though a lot of players say that, it's become something of a sports cliche. I took it at face value because Nader actually lived it, and he was rewarded for it. Wooden saw his backup center's unselfishness, knew he wanted to go pro, and did what he could to help. He continually reminded Nader that being coached by him and going up against Walton every day in practice was the best thing for his game. Wooden even did what he could to help get the professional scouts to notice his unselfish backup center. Part of the reason we won was that I made Bill Walton better, Nader says now. In his post-basketball life, as an executive, he continues to emphasize the importance of the same principles. He preaches getting rid of the ego that wants to be fed and putting that energy back into the collective. Immediately recognize the people that helped you, whatever success that was, he says. I make a point to include others so I can give credit if something good happens. As a 20-year-old kid, it's not that Nader didn't have the same selfish desire that most have. He just chose not to develop that part of himself, and over time, it drained away. What was left was an unselfishness that laid the groundwork for his future and inspired others, including me. I was the most egotistical player they would ever meet. My ego is not a personal ego. It's a team ego. My ego demands, for myself, the success of my team. Bill Russell. Team ego. Winning athletes understand how to operate and succeed within the team structure. That kind of leadership trickles down to everyone else. Unselfishness doesn't mean not being competitive or committed. It means that those personality traits are channeled into the team's mission and not toward one's own acclaim. Hall of Famer Bill Russell didn't just preach unselfishness. The winningest player in NBA history, he won 11 titles in 13 years with the Celtics, walked the walk. Russell's commitment to the defensive end of the court, where accolades are less common, is what made him a legend. Though he was clearly the alpha male on every one of his teams and the best player in the league for more than a decade, It was his reputation as a loyal teammate that made him one of the most respected players to ever step on the court. In fact, his unselfishness stretched so far that he even declined his induction into the Pro Basketball Hall of Fame. The reason? He told a reporter he wanted to be celebrated for team play, not individual accomplishment. Note to listener, Russell has given other reasons over the years for declining, including racial inequality in the Hall and in the league during his playing days. Here's a self-test. Teammate audit. Take 15 or so index cards. Write the name of a colleague on each card. Every workday, send one of them one of three things. 1, someone you know who may benefit them, and ask if they'd like an introduction. 2, something you know that may add value to them, a book recommendation, an article, or a video. 3, an inquiry to see how they are doing and what you can help with. Hey, how are things in your world? Unity. Strive to be the best for the team, not the best on the team. Instead of looking around and belittling those under you and being jealous of those above you, find a way to work with them. It will behoove everyone, including yourself. The old saying is that a rising tide lifts all boats. Being part of a successful team will ultimately burnish your own career. Demonstrate your unselfishness by making a point to credit others and take the blame when appropriate. Pat Riley, who has head coach for both the Los Angeles Lakers and the Miami Heat, has 5 championship rings stretching over 25 years, has seen what it takes to build and sustain a championship team. Riley also has another 2 rings as team president for the Heat. Because of that, he has also had a front row seat to what can tear one apart. Riley famously coined the term disease of me to describe what happens over the course of a championship team's trajectory. In the beginning, everyone is in it for the team and for that ring. But once success arrives, people start looking out for themselves, bemoaning the credit or attention or money they aren't getting, forgetting what made them winners in the first place. The disease of me is a sickness of selfishness, and it ultimately destroys a winning culture. The glue that keeps a team together is eroded. The chemistry that is lost doesn't just reappear. In his book, The Ideal Team Player, management expert Patrick Lencioni explains that team players need to be humble, hungry, and smart. He clarified that he means people smart. They share credit, emphasize team over self, and define success collectively rather than individually. Inevitably, the snake who's only looking to climb the corporate ladder will infect everyone else on the team. Decades ago, that personality might have been rewarded, but times and culture have changed significantly. Even top talent is not enough to overcome a selfish attitude. For instance, Netflix openly advertises the fact that they don't hire brilliant jerks because the cost to effective teamwork is too high. No one, in any industry, is good enough at what he does to get a pass for being selfish. 1 + 1 = 3. Studies show that virtually all of us want to be a part of something bigger than ourselves, a member of a tribe, group, or team. It's in our animal nature. Though that's true, it is also true that we are born selfish beings. We all come out of the womb looking out for ourselves and doing what's in our own best interest. It's only natural. For a team to be great, on some level, that instinct has to be unlearned and that mindset has to shift. You need to care about the team's needs, vision, and mission as much as your own personal agenda. That's not easy. Swin Nader didn't become an unselfish player overnight. It took working with and buying into a team system for him to get it. It's not you versus me, it's you plus me. With that mindset, there's exponential growth. My friend's dad used to say that on good teams, 1 + 1 = 2, but on great teams, 1 + 1 = 3. Think about a basketball team. It's natural for the backup point guard to feel he is in competition against the starting point guard, but that's a toxic mindset and it erodes the team fabric. A point guard can't succeed on his own anyway. He's usually measured by how much better he makes his teammates. In fact, all players are now measured by this criteria. His success is tied directly to the success of the other 4 players on the court. The backup's mentality needs to be, what can I do to make the starter even better? That doesn't mean the backup shouldn't want that starting job. He should hustle his butt off and, like Tom Brady, be in a position to take over if the opportunity ever arises. It just means he shouldn't be ruled by that outcome. Don't be so self-directed that you miss the point of being a member of a team. A rising tide lifts all boats. One Ball in Houston. Unselfishness is most acutely required when there's more than one star on a team or in a group. Two or three stars don't double or triple a team's chances of winning by their mere presence. There needs to be a commitment to unselfishness, or else some of the star power starts to cancel itself out. In the summer of 2017, when Chris Paul was traded to the Houston Rockets, the doubters took to the streets, or more accurately, to social media. There was no way in the world this would work. It was going to be a disaster. How would Chris Paul, who needed to have the ball to play his game, coexist with James Harden, who needed the ball even more? The previous season, Harden led the NBA in possession time, and Paul was seventh. As the saying goes, there's only one ball. The naysayers made some noise, but Houston ended the season with the best record in the league by a healthy margin. How did that happen? You do what you have to do on the team that you're on, Paul told a reporter. That's the way the game works. This is a sneaky, brilliant quote, by the way. That's exactly how games work. Of course, players are media trained to say unselfish things, but the statistics and the Rockets' record bear this out. Not only that, but Harden won league MVP that year, proving he didn't have to lessen his game to work with Paul. They didn't each take a step back to win. They took a step toward each other. First, both stars knew there were plenty of possessions and shots to feed two scorers. Second, when a team adds another threat, opportunities open up, and the Rockets capitalized on this. Before Paul joined the Rockets, defenses could plan and scheme to shut down Harden and make him the focal point. When the Rockets added another legitimate scorer in Paul, teams couldn't focus solely on Harden, or Paul would torch them. As someone who wants to play alongside other great players, Paul is empowered, not threatened, by pairing up with Harden. Two superstar players on the same team chose to raise each other's level of effort and focus. Of course, all this could be true of any 1-2 punch, but it took Harden and Paul to both buy in, to unselfishly embrace the other's presence, for it to work. According to the NBA's all-important plus-minus statistic, which measures how effective a team is when an individual is on the court, Paul and Harden currently rank numbers 1 and 2 in the league. More proof that 1 plus 1 equals 3. The Quiet Alpha. In the world of basketball, it is nearly impossible to preach the power of unselfishness without touching on the king of unselfishness, the San Antonio Spurs Hall of Famer Tim Duncan. Duncan's attitude goes way back. While at Wake Forest, Tim Duncan actually co-authored an academic paper called Blowhards, Snobs, and Narcissists, Interpersonal Reactions to Excessive Egotism. It was an early peek at Duncan's attitude, which would help him claim the title as the most unselfish Hall of Famer in NBA history. Duncan came into the league as a highly touted rookie and the number one overall pick. However, unlike more than a handful of top picks who put up some impressive numbers for a limited amount of years and then vanish, Duncan became one of the all-time greats. Talent? Of course. But all those guys were extremely talented. Those who flame out never quite lose their feeling that, as the number one pick, they deserve to be treated like a number one pick. But Duncan didn't seem interested in that at all. As a young player, Duncan responded to the mentoring of veteran David Robinson, flourished under the team concept instilled by coach Greg Popovich, alternated his position constantly depending on the team's makeup, wasn't a top 10 scorer, though he easily could have been, played off the ball, took less money so there was more room under the salary cap to sign other talent, and never said a word about his retirement until the season was over, avoiding the goodbye tours that most legends embark on during their last season. He is the quietest alpha dog the sport has ever produced, and most argue, the greatest power forward of all time. By lowering himself, Sam Walker wrote in The Captain Class, Duncan was able to coax the maximum performance out of the players around him. Did some people give Duncan a hard time because he was an introvert, not interested in self-glory? Sure, but he had made a decision that to achieve the pinnacle in a team sport, he had to focus on what mattered, collective success. Even though he is retired, it's obvious that his shadow looms large. The Spurs culture, with obvious credit to coach Greg Popovich, who's still there, continues to be among the healthiest and most team-oriented in professional sports. The myth of the taker. There's a misconception, in business and in sports, that unselfish people get trampled on, that if you don't look out for yourself, you're bound to get burned. But it's a myth, and a poisonous one at that. As I discussed in Chapter 9, in his book Give and Take, researcher Adam Grant demonstrates how the highest performers, across the board, are actually givers. Their generosity earns them deep and lasting respect, he wrote. The team supports givers, helping them reach their full potential. Givers are recognized as such and get lifted by a group that recognizes and values that giving. There's something distinctive that happens when givers succeed. It spreads and cascades. Givers succeed in a way that creates a ripple effect, enhancing the success of people around them. Grant also noticed that, on a practical level, givers keep themselves out of the rat race. Fewer people are gunning for them. Because of this, colleagues are more likely to buy into givers' ideas because he's been established as not being motivated by self-interest. People are attracted to the giver. They trust the giver. They want to assist the giver and work with the giver. The giver is the one who endures. I think of them as the opposite of John Gordon's energy vampires. The givers fill and feed the culture instead of detracting from it. The negative impact of a taker is double or triple the positive impact of a giver, Grant calculated. With one taker on a team, you begin to notice that paranoia spreads and people hold back out of fear that they'll be exploited. All of us are givers, to some extent, I hope, in our personal lives, but we feel a need to take, or at least balance our giving and taking in the workplace like it's a profit and loss statement. Maybe we don't want to be seen as too generous because then we'll be perceived as soft or pushovers. Maybe we're worried what people would think or how we might be taken advantage of. If we fight through those stereotypes, we'll recognize that unselfishness and generosity in the workplace build success. You can be assertive and ambitious, but still be a team player by channeling those drives into the group's success, not just your own. Giving and winning are not mutually exclusive. Just ask Swin Nader and Tim Duncan and Chris Paul and James Harden and Bill Russell. Key point. What makes or breaks a team, all teams, is how much each member is willing to sacrifice self-interest and self-glory for team success. Remember, a team is a group of people who each puts the group's needs ahead of his own. Every act of selfishness erodes the team's fabric. Each of us has an instinctive drive towards self-interest. A team chooses to put this aside in service of a larger goal. A group will find success if they scrap you versus me and replace it with you plus me. With that mindset, 1 + 1 = 3. Unselfishness is not about charity or just basic kindness. It has been proven as an effective approach to achieving and succeeding.
Well, that's it for me. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please make sure to join my conversations at Alan Stein Jr. on all major social platforms and go to alansteinjr.com to subscribe to my full timeout, 30-second timeout, and overtime monthly emails. I look forward to helping you raise your game.